Good evening, everybody. My name is Dr. Carla Sharp. I would like to welcome everyone again to one of our talks in the 2018-2019 podcast series, NEABPD podcast series. We are very fortunate tonight to have Chris Grimes, who will be presenting on mentalization-based therapy with adolescents and families. Chris is a licensed clinical social worker here in Houston, Texas. I've known Chris quite a few years when our time overlapped at the Menninger Clinic. Chris is currently in private practice here in Houston, but up until about 2015, he was a social worker at the Menninger Clinic. Chris continues to be a clinical instructor at Baylor College of Medicine in the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Fellowship Program, as well as the social work program for the Menninger Clinic. He's also an adjunct professor doing some training and teaching at University of Houston. So it's a great pleasure for me, Chris, to welcome you. I will hand over to you. I do invite folks to post questions if they have them. I am going to see if I can quickly find that email address again. Yes, it's neabpdcalls@aol.com. neabpdcalls@aol.com. Please do send questions through to Dr. Perry Hoffman. She'll send them on to me and I can bring up those questions. Chris will talk for a little bit, and then him and I will just have a to-and-fro discussion about his talk. But Chris, very welcome, and thank you so much. We're so happy to have you.
Thank you so much. I'm very honored to be here, and thank you to NEABPD and GAP, and of course all my mentalizing mentors and role models here. Throughout the years, in particular, Menninger Clinic and Baylor College of Medicine and U of H, who've supported me in really sharing what I know with early and future clinicians, and certainly a passion of mine, and to share about mentalizing in this work. So, again, thank you, Carla, and I appreciate this platform today. You know, to be clear, much of the info that I will provide today comes from PowerPoints, things I've learned from the mentors in my field, John Allen and Efren and Vonnegut and Bateman and Dick and Bevington and these guys, and certainly Carla Sharp and Laura Williams. So throughout, you're going to hopefully I will share more about the different resources out there, and glad to offer any of this as I can to new clinicians or families. So my presentation today is going to focus on mentalization-based family therapy. And I was introduced as a new clinician. I was introduced to mentalizing at the Menninger Clinic, and it really paved the way for me as a young person in this field, and not just professionally but personally, was quite helpful. And I really, at Menninger, I really learned a lot about family therapy, and this is my primary role in working with young people there and families. So it's my honor to still be, you know, to be able to now to talk about mentalizing and share this with families. And I do so daily in my practice as well. So in thinking about mentalizing, and as you look at slide three, I'm going to move forward to kind of what mentalizing is. In other podcasts, certainly, you've probably heard this come more eloquently. But the idea here is mentalizing is something that we all do naturally, not always well. And we know that psychiatric diagnosis really can get in the way of mentalizing. So Dr. Bateman earlier today gave a podcast and spoke about mentalization-based treatment and the different realms in which we will practice. Family work in particular is looking at helping clients look at the relationships and mentalize in the context of relationships. So when we're doing mentalizing, when we're defining mentalizing, what we're looking at is attending to the mental states of in self and others, holding mind in mind, mindfulness of mind, And all of these, you know, these three at least on this slide here, discusses attending or paying attention to mental states. And that's important, and we do more than that. We become aware of what is going on, and then we also try to understand or create a story around what's going on with ourselves and others. And as I learn what I'm feeling, I can also learn the reason you're feeling that way, or I'm feeling that way, and the reason you're feeling the way you are. So this brings a bit more than mindfulness into this definition. Also, one definition I like to think about in mentalizing is understanding misunderstandings. And this happens all the time, especially in the context of our family system. And in therapy, we will absolutely do that in mentalizing. Face therapy is to slow down and understand, how did we get here? How are we all feeling so misunderstood? We're also supporting the family to see themselves from the outside and others from the inside. We know that mentalizing is much more than empathy. It's also empathy for the self as well as others. And we're also interested in what someone feels when they do what they do, and what feelings drive them into action. Mentalizing is also a part of that, as seeing your role in relationships. So when we're mentalizing, this is something we all do naturally. We all, you know, that we all do non-mentalizing as well, and it's important just to kind of think about this. Bateman also discussed earlier today, Dr. Bateman, he discussed the non-mentalizing modes, and this happens certainly within the family system, and we're certainly looking for those modes throughout. So as we look at the mentalizing stance, as a therapist, we're really trying to model this for our families and the adolescents in which we work with. So in order for relationships to go well, we really do need mentalizing. And we're really providing, as therapists, a secure base for these families to explore, to feel safe, to then explore their minds and the minds of other people in their family. And this also takes enough. So the psychological aspects of mentalizing, we're inquisitive, we're curious, we're playful, and we're open-minded. And we need to be able to really ask in the moment, do people get in me? Are people getting me right now? Are they understanding one another? And ultimately, this is a not knowing stance. It's I don't really know what's in your mind, but I'm really curious. And the truth is, if we go into your mind, together we might learn something new. If I am curious and inquisitive, hopefully that leads to more curiosity on your part and less defensiveness. So it's just kind of the psychological aspects. This gets into the ethical aspects, as John Ellen likes to talk about. When we mentalize, we treat others as persons rather than objects. Really, I think from this attitude of the stance, we're very compassionate. We're encouraging compassion for self and others, really trying to have a sense of what's going on in that other person, that they might do what they do or respond the way they do. We're moving towards acceptance of others and maybe acceptance of what's happened, and ideally forgiveness in the context of difficult interactions and how do we move forward together. Forgiveness is kind of at the heart of that. And also respect for autonomy, that each person has their own mind in the room. Each person has the right to express their own feelings, desires, needs, wishes, and to be heard. And certainly overall, if we think about these things, we can imagine a loving, caring, kind environment and attitude, of course, with the mentalizing stance. And there's some good YouTube there on what is mentalizing and why do it by John Allen, and gets into more of this. It's really nice. So you can find that on YouTube. So briefly, the factors that interfere with mentalizing. The first is strong emotions. It's really hard to imagine what's in someone else's mind and your own when there's a significant amount of, for instance, fear involved. It's really hard to be curious. Talk about, of course, the tiger that just automatically ends up in my office out of nowhere, and try to help the family understand what would they do, and the automatic responses that we do, a fight or flight freeze to protect ourselves. And mentalizing shuts down in those moments of fear. For good reason, right? Another emotion would be anger, right? It's family systems. We may blame rather than understand. We may push blame on others or have a hard time accepting, that we've hurt someone in a family. But anger really makes it difficult. The response ultimately to understand ourselves and others, and of course shame. Shame is we actually want to hide ourselves from others and even ourselves if we can. And then infatuation, this happens in any relationship when maybe it's just going and you have the butterfly effect and we may miss red flags because we're not quite mentalizing the big picture. So strong emotions, and then we also bump into defensiveness and how mentalizing is impacted by defensiveness within within all relationships. And this automatic defensiveness when we feel attacked or others aren't understanding us can lead to more defensiveness, maybe more attacks. And the idea that we also may not want to know what's going on in someone else's mind as well. And then indifference is another factor that might interfere, depending on the level of care we give about a topic or our ability to even imagine what is in someone else's mind if we're feeling quite depressed or alone. So those are some of the factors that interfere with mentalizing. And as we go into the next slide, we talk more about the mentalizing stance. And of course, this is throughout all aspects of the mentalizing-based treatment. Is the stance in which the therapist holds and enters into the relationship with their clients. So it's an attitude to hold in relationships. It's a stance, a way of being with clients and family members, and an attitude toward relationships, to relationships, how we interact with others. So one family member was actually a parent. He talked with me after kind of our work together, and he was kind of wrapping up what he was kind of learning. And he says, I tend to get furious when things don't go my way or something happens with my child. And what I've learned, and it's one of the most difficult things, is to actually stay curious. So he says, to himself in the moment, don't be furious, be curious, or stay curious, not furious. So this is his way of really reminding himself what's really helpful, and even getting to a place of understanding himself in the moment and being able to kind of show up differently with his kids and his spouse. So the idea that he's going into this and kind of having to kind of step back and see himself from the outside and not kind of go to those automatic responses is not easy. But as a therapist in this stance, we're kind of doing several things. We're modeling mentalizing. So we're showing for families there are new ways of interacting with one another. We know that mentalizing begets more mentalizing. So non-mentalizing begets non-mentalizing. So we're helping them slow down, consider each other's perspective, take a break, pause if we need to. But helping them see there's new ways, you have choices on how to respond. The second is kind of the function of the stance is to give the client the experience of being mentalized. Certainly, given the strong emotions and the hurt and the hurtful patterns that may go on for long, long time in families, sitting with the client and each person in the family having their space to really feel heard and their perspective taken in can be quite powerful. And we know there's a nice little video from Dr. Deacon Bevington where he talks about why mentalizing particularly matters, and how we learn to ask and receive kind of help, and how being mentalized kind of opens the door to trust and that this treatment actually can help, or mom and dad are actually interested in learning what's really been going on with me. And vice versa, right? The kid's actually interested in talking about, how they've impacted the family or how difficult it is for the parents. So this this sense of being mentalized, it's kind of, I like to think about it as the glue, mentalizing as the glue for attachment relationships to kind of, support secure attachment, a safe haven of sorts to really explore some difficult things among members who may have really been hurt by one another or just due to intentional, non-intentional kind of issues. So, then the third function is encourages the client to mentalize. So once, typically for adolescents, I'm really helps getting the parents in a place where they can hear and be curious. This allows the client to feel validated and heard and seen and soothed in the session. And ultimately, I think, gives the client the chance to then think about what's going on with their family. And it creates these conditions where the client is better able to do this mentalizing as well. So you have the modeling, the mentalizing, giving the client the experience of being mentalized, encouraging the client to mentalize themselves. So this next slide is certainly not a new slide, and this is from Dick and Bevington. Dr. Bevington, he discusses, he's got a picture of his pup here, but as I'm describing it, really this is showing kind of the crux of the mentalizing stance and what it sounds like a bit. We're going to get into more of this with a case, but we're certainly being curious. How must it feel to be you right now, mom and dad? Why are you so angry? What's going on? I keep getting in trouble over all these behaviors. Why do I do that? What is that about? Right? So this is more reflection. You can certainly hear the difference. Awareness of the impact, the effect. How do we impact one another? And maybe you being so upset and noisy is making you forget how much you really care about me. Not knowing, we don't really know. We never know what's in the mind of someone else, but I know that I don't know what you must think, but I can wonder, right? I can try to guess. And that's kind of the spirit of mentalizing. Along with a sense of narrative continuity, which really is this idea of a story, right? Why do I do what I do? Where does that come from? He talks about, is there something about me and rabbits that stems from my childhood? I wonder. So he goes, he's got this automatic kind of mentalizing. Of course, the idea here is to be curious and to be reflective and to model that. So that's the mentalizing stance. As we go into the next slide, we're looking at mentalizing families in particular. And so we talk about the context of families. There's no context that is more likely to induce a loss of mentalizing than family interactions. Here, relationships tend to be at their most fraught, most loving, their most intense emotionally. So the stage is set on a daily basis for interactions that potentially stimulate a loss of mentalizing in one or more family members. So very quickly, mentalizing can be lost. And it's important in those moments for the families to learn what happened very quickly to do something different. Of course, we know that's very difficult too. As we go to the next slide and we're thinking about what it must be like for family members, as I sit in my office and have a new family come in, I really try to put myself in their shoes and what it's like for them and why they're coming in. And I have to know it, think that it takes tremendous courage, trust, and sometimes desperation on the parts of family members to present and engage in family work. I mean, we're asking them to put themselves under the microscope to some degree. At least they feel that way, right? Parents are coming and asking for help regarding parenting and understanding their child. To acknowledge they don't know maybe how to help their child is not an easy thing, right? Families also being willing to understand that they may be contributing to the presenting symptoms. Really helping family members, not feel blamed and realize blame's not going to be helpful, but that maybe there is something that we're contributing, and we may not even be aware of it, to the overall difficulties. And the issue is it's kind of that walking the tightrope of blame and also really kind of ownership. And so the idea is that if there's a 2% that everybody can own, even me as the therapist, there's a lot that none of us have anything to do about, and that's the 98% there. So you know, we can only kind of work with what maybe we're bringing to the table and what we understand from other people. So, of course, opening up and being vulnerable is very scary, especially with the ones we love and who know us best. Changing behaviors or ways of communicating and other patterns certainly is not easy if we've been doing the same thing, especially if we've been doing the same thing for many years. And the question is, I mean, for families, why would someone continue to do something self-damaging, whether it's self-injury or whatever it might be, drug use? Why does someone continue to do that? And this is a question that's a fair question, but one that's so hard to understand. Education in this place, in this education, therefore, is really important in helping family members, and APPD is amazing as they help family members understand the skills and self-care crucial to supporting family members. So all these skills are important, and education is so important. So the idea that, you know, we get to patients, we support the family in getting to a place where they can understand how they impact one another and how their behavior impacts the family system, and maybe even being able to describe that for themselves to their family. Okay, if I haven't confused you enough, I hope this is a good kind of introduction to kind of family therapy. And as we get going here, I'm going to share a case, just going to give us a chance to think about a family and a little bit more about what we do in our family sessions. Okay, so as we think about Anne, Joe, and Mary here, Anne is a 13-year-old Caucasian female who just started seventh grade at a local public school. She enjoys theater, especially musicals and school musicals. She's the oldest of four children to Mary and Joe. She has no previous history of psychiatric treatment, and her mother initially presents indicating that since Anne returned from her summer theater camp, she began self-injury, talking about suicide and death, and her grades have been slipping. Joe feels certain that Anne picked this up, quote, self-injury at camp, and indicated that she will not return next summer despite her love of theater and this experience. Mom believes that her behavior is manipulative and indicates she does not seem to care about what anyone is thinking or saying, won't take any advice. As Mom describes Anne, she appears certain about what is in Anne's mind, indicating she has never had any issues like this with her daughter, and believe this is all for attention and to get out of work. She has no other way of really understanding what's going on for Anne, so this is what she kind of imagines. From Anne's perspective, Anne says she suddenly begins to panic. She's unable to describe exactly what happens to her prior to her self-injury as if it just happens to her. All of a sudden, for instance, she indicates suddenly she'll be in English class, she'll begin to feel panic, she'll ask to be excused, and she finds herself in the bathroom where she cuts herself and she'll hit her ankle repeatedly. So she went to the computer lab shortly after going to the bathroom where she emailed her mom with the subject line, emergency. The mom, Mary, rushes to the school where she finds Anne in her class, in her next class. Anne appears fine, though, denies any stress and lets her mom know, okay, I'm fine, it's okay. Mom can leave, I'll finish school. Later that evening, Mary notices the cuts to Anne's arm and really struggles to put into words what she's thinking, feeling, and leading, and what kind of feeling leads to the self-injury. There were several other instances where parents often felt confused as to what has actually happened to Anne. So some of the things that we notice initially about kind of mom's behavior, kind of some of the family members' behavior, is that Mary, mom, does regular body checks on her daughter as she gets out of the shower. Mary sleeps with her daughter in a room at night to keep her from cutting and killing herself. And Mary tends to speak for Anne. And Anne tends to look to mom when she is asked questions about how she feels. Ask mom. She knows she really can understand me better than me. Joe appears curious and interested and really wanting to help, but really struggles to approach Anne and know how to connect with her at an emotional level. And he's often away for work. Anne appears to have very little feelings related to her mom's intrusive, seemingly intrusive behaviors. And Joe indicates mom is not sleeping well, quite anxious and is terrified that Anne will kill herself. And Anne doesn't really feel that her parents understand or care about her. She also feels disconnected from her peers. So just to, you know, a few initial observations as I've interviewed each family member and kind of getting to know them and kind of how they respond to one another when using and working towards a mentalizing formulation of sorts and to understand those moments where mentalizing gets offline. I have a brief video here developed by students and quite clever on explaining panic or pause, explaining self-injury and what's helpful and what's not. It's quite an interesting little video. If you want to check it out, there's the video. It's on YouTube there. So, but this gets at kind of the automatic response from parents and how sometimes those are helpful and maybe not so helpful. Okay, so we'll come back to Anne. But, you know, briefly, the family work really provides an opportunity to foster mentalizing in relationships with family members, an area where mentalizing may be especially challenging, but also very crucial. We understand from attachment theory and research how, you know, the importance of attachment early on in kids learning about themselves and the world around them and trusting and who to trust and who how their own mind works. So the idea here in family work, it's so crucial that we look at when even long patterns of non-mentalizing are taking place. So the idea with family therapists, we are going to certainly emphasize the importance of communication and dialogue, really trying to understand what each other is thinking and feeling and not doing the work for them, but slowing down enough where each member is able to talk about what's in their mind and make sense of themselves. So we're not telling them what to feel or think or what to say or interpret behavior as much as we're really being curious and providing that space. So we achieve mutual understanding through this dialogue and doing so when there's good mentalizing conditions. So I'm going to come back to As Treatment Progresses with Anne in a minute. So I'm going to continue where with mentalizing families, slide 16. So, of course, we know anxiety is a common impediment. And I guess going back to Anne, we can think about mom's reactions and how it makes sense that mom will do whatever it takes to keep her safe. And we also have to look to see if how helpful is that for either one of them. The family therapist can serve as this mediator to kind of foster this kind of discussion in the face of the intensity of suicide or self-injury and those emotions that come along. So we're helping the family learn how to mentalize emotionally in the context of family interactions. And this provides the most direct opportunity to generalize what is learned in sessions to home life. So the goal of mentalization-based therapy, really, of course, a lot of therapies, is to encourage the self-healing process as they go home between sessions. So we're really reflecting on, you know, what's been going well, not so well over the last week. But let's talk about moments that didn't go well and rewind and kind of look at those aspects of where non-mentalizing happened and how to get back on track. And we're actually able to talk about some of these things in sessions. And then as they go out, they're learning how to pause, learning how to slow down, learning how to use their skills in order to do something different. And as we move to slide 17, we help them learn, we enhance their mentalizing, the capacity to make choices, to do something different in that moment. And so we're considering each person's involvement, as we discussed, hopefully looking at that, and we're using mentalizing to strengthen self-control and the capacity to regulate one's feelings. I remember early on when I was working at the Menninger Clinic, we were really a kind of a mentalizing unit that the families were able to, the kids really learned what mentalizing is and was able to use it in their family sessions where they say, "You're not mentalizing me." It was really nice, and it really got to this idea of understand me and their ability to say to their family, oh, you're not getting it. But it helped provide a framework for them to speak to things that maybe they even couldn't speak to. They don't may not even know what they're feeling, but they can say, you're not getting me. And that's really important. So as the families, so as we go to slide 18, we're promoting the family's sense of confidence and helping their loved one develop this skill. Of course, our parents really do need to learn how to manage their own emotion dysregulation and look at their own family of origin history, what's showing up with their families, and their ability to maintain that sweet spot in the emotion regulation that allows them to really mentalize and comprehend their child, or at least go back and repair after maybe a rupture. We're encouraging the family to practice the skills of mentalizing, communication, and problem solving in the specific areas in which mentalizing has been inhibited. We'll talk about that a few minutes here in a moment. And of course, Dr. Bevington does a lot of this with AMBIT in the UK, but the idea of supporting the whole family in the context we're initiating activities and context within the family with peers, the school, with work, community, which is going to reinforce this mentalizing, communication skills, and support the family in problem solving. So we're looking at the broader context for this family and young person, and supporting them, and kind of everybody having the same kind of way of seeing them and their struggles. So helping the family shift from also coercive, non-mentalizing cycles of interaction to mentalization-based discussions and interactions. So the more we have repair after a rupture, the more we can kind of slow down and really understand what's behind anger or non-mentalizing has been going on in the relationship. The more we do this repair, the more secure the attachment between the adult young person and the family. So that's ultimately what we're going for. Now on slide 19, you'll see promoting mentalizing. So as a therapist, there's quite a few things I can do to promote mentalizing, and that's inviting multiple perspectives. We're also between everyone, right? What is mom thinking? What is dad thinking? How does mom imagine Annie's thinking about this? Annie, can you imagine what it felt like for dad? And hearing those perspectives and being curious is crucial. We're also helping the family acknowledge what you do not, or we're also acknowledging what we do not know as a therapist, and we're going to enlist the patient for help. We're going to talk to families about coming on as a psychologist of sorts, or you know, an investigator with me to really be curious and learn about their child, and seeing them as the expert, and acknowledging what I do not know, and that promotes trust. It promotes their own curiosity, I believe, with regards to joining the therapist. So the here and now does show the mind in action. So when I can use in the moment with clients, if I can share, I'm really having a hard time because everybody's talking together and at the same time, and it makes it difficult for me to really understand what everybody's feeling, and I might even have my hands on my head kind of saying, I don't understand, or it's too much right now. But it's my way to kind of show them, here's how my mind is working and how you guys impact me as well. We're going to do a lot of validation before offering alternatives, if we're even going to offer alternatives. The idea is that for the patient to model for the family and for the young person that your perspective matters, tell us, and it's in detail, rich detail, what it's like for them, and to really sit with it, again, before we jump to something else. We're also being judicious with our self-disclosure and really being, you know, clear with the client's boundary setting and so forth, but also sharing what it's like for us and that it's okay to share what's in our mind with our clients, to have that transparent nature. We're certainly not going to burden our patients, though, with our own difficulties. We're also acknowledging our own mentalizing failures and mistakes. Again, in the here and now, especially when that happens, when I'm bound to miss or misinterpret something, that client has said is to really back up and say, you know, I really missed that, and make amends, and to really acknowledge, I didn't get that. But next time, and please next time let me know if I didn't get it, just like you did, because it's really helpful. So we're acknowledging mistakes, and we're marking for them how helpful it is for them to let us know when we didn't get it right. We're also looking at, I think I love this still because I can be playful. I can use playfulness in my work. It's a lot of games and activities that you can just make up, and there's the various mentalizing manuals do have games and activities to kind of encourage mentalizing, to keep mentalizing going, to kind of talk about serious things in maybe a not so serious way. And of course, I think the humor is important. Certainly not mocking, but we're kind of being playful. We're approaching things with a very humble attitude. We don't know, but we want to find out. We're not the expert. You guys are. So, so that's promoting mentalizing. And then as we get into avoiding, we're going to try to avoid undermining mentalizing. And so slide 20 discusses various things we can do to undermine mentalizing. When I'm trying to be clever, and I think I have a really clever answer for that, and I'm kind of thinking as the client's finishing talking, I'm not mentalizing, right? I'm in my own mind. And likely what I think is clever is going to sound confusing to the client. Maybe not, but likely. Any complicated, long interventions where I might get lost in describing what the intervention is or something is likely not going to meet the client where they're what they are and what they need, but it's going to disrupt the mentalizing process. Psychobabble's the same way. Certainly, I do use the word mentalizing, but I certainly don't need to in some cases either. But I'm just describing the process and trying to do so in a way that the client really understands. Also, theory-based assumptions, certainty, when we think we know we're interpreting what's happening for the patient, we know it's about this and that, we're not first letting the client figure that out. And we are likely wrong. I'm likely wrong as I am certain in that moment. And then let's see, when we attribute patient's experience to a general pattern rather than that specific detail, just talking about is really sitting and being curious and understanding the feelings and all the different experiences rather than kind of saying, oh, here it is. This is the pattern, right? But we're really looking at detail at what happened next. Tell me more. Okay. Long silences is the same kind of thing. It can be helpful, but for clients who struggle with being regulated and not knowing what's in someone else's mind and actually hypermentalizing, where they're kind of any thoughts in the other person's mind responding in a way, the idea here is kind of like hypermentalizing, and this long silence might not provide enough containment for those unknown thoughts in the moment. Okay, so as we look at, we're going to move down to slide 22, the difficulties in mentalizing within the family context. Interpersonal stress is one. So this is within the family context when there's stress growing up for the young person or the family. You know, it could be parental conflict, divorce, parents worried about self-injury or drugs. Maybe there's a loss in the family or maybe physical illness. But some sort of interpersonal stress really makes it difficult for caregivers and young people alike to really think about what other people are feeling and thinking. The second one here is caregivers are preoccupied with important concrete issues in life. So examples would be crisis at work, worried about finances, focused on grades. Maybe there's multiple kids in the home with difficulties. Or maybe even a parent is going back to school. These concrete issues in life might interfere with the ability to kind of really mentalize at the house. Members withholding mental states. There are very good reasons children, adolescents, even adults might hold withhold feeling states from others, mental states from others. Maybe they don't want to worry their parents or spouse by sharing what's in their mind. Maybe it's shame related to some sort of trauma. We don't know how someone's going to react if we share this information, or it's not safe because of some sort of alcoholism in the family or drug use to really talk about things. Also, 23 talks about longstanding mental health problems, such as mental family members with PTSD, MDD or eating disorders, major depression or eating disorders, or certainly personality disorders. But if there's someone who's not getting treatment, it makes it very difficult for the young person to understand what's going on. You know, why is dad so angry? Why is mom not eating? Or why am I getting blamed for everything? But there's still these long-standing mental health problems that certainly can lead to difficulties in mental life. Also, poor boundaries within the family. We discussed Anne earlier, says, I wish my mom was here because she knows how to answer that. She knows my mind better than me. Also, misuse of mentalizing. So when maybe someone, like a mom, for instance, understands that a child is sad after they visit their father, she might say, whenever you visit your father, you feel so sad afterwards. Shouldn't you stop seeing him? Certainly, it's a discussion to have, but it feels very much the agenda of the mother, and really kind of failing to think about what it's like for the kid and what it's really like for him, the father, or what else might be causing him to be sad. So these are kind of difficulties in mentalizing within the family context. And then we get into specific techniques. So this is 24. Slide 24 talks about, so the pause button is a button that actually I have some families create together using model magic. This is some clay, and we'll sit and we'll all make pause buttons, including myself, and you know, encourage them to think about what calms them down, what do they use to manage their emotions, or something that kind of leads them to think, remember, you know, calmness and relaxing and a way to kind of slow down. And so we'll talk about the pause button and the idea that is kind of like a timeout in basketball where the coach is kind of seeing their team out there playing, and anybody can call a timeout, right? When the players, if they're not understanding the play or something's confused, you can call timeout, and the team can kind of come together to say, what's happening here? Or, you know, have a few minutes to kind of get their minds together. And then from there, you know, we go back to it. We go back to the game. We don't not come back to it, right? Just a pause, and then we can go back and maybe do something different. So really, I have a pause button in my office. Sometimes kids just learn that they can push it and that means something. We don't even have to discuss it. It's just sitting there. But they typically will push it when they feel misunderstood or maybe they're confused or overwhelmed. Role plays are just a huge part of what we do, what I do with families. I get them to think, pretend to be the other person and looking at a situation that didn't kind of go well. So the young person might be the mom, and then the mother might be the son, and they have a way of, you know, working through a situation together. And, you know, the child really realizes what it's like to be mom and vice versa. So, it's a really powerful way of helping them put themselves in other people's shoes and understanding why people do what they do. Another thing is when I hear the pronoun we coming from a young person, and that's me and my mom or me and my dad, or we decided this, kind of using challenging that due to the idea of we all have separate minds and maybe we all have thoughts and feelings that are different. We have the Columbo curiosity, really want to know and I'm curious. We're modeling the mentalizing and of course psychoeducation, kind of simmering down, getting the emotions to slow down, and then again, use of self. And then just this mentalizing hand that we can really say, let's slow down. And that's kind of like directing traffic, air traffic a bit. But it's kind of using the hand and slowing people down and kind of maybe even interrupting, but letting them know early on that you're going to probably need to do that and let them know why you're doing what you do. Okay, so that's some mentalizing techniques. Another one here is the mentalizing loop, which I'm not sure how much time I have to actually go through all of this, but I can describe this in some detail here and briefly. Mentalizing loop is this, it's really a major tool, and this is on slide 25 for devising these interventions. And this can be done individually or within the family, but it provides this framework for connecting the therapist observations of different family interactional patterns with underlying feeling states and related thoughts. So it allows the therapist to structure sessions, focus on specific patterns, and encourage families to consider change. So it kind of provides this roadmap for therapists and families to identify these patterns when they're feeling stuck or misunderstood. It marks for the family how it feels to be in this non-mentalizing situation and what it looks like in the family context. So slide 26 is the map, and I'll briefly go through each one. First, you have notice and name. Two is mentalizing the moment. And three is generalize and consider change. And in between each one, you have checking. We're constantly checking to make sure if we have it right. Remember, we don't know for sure what's in someone's mind or if they get it unless we ask. So going to moving to slide 28, we're going to notice an interaction, something in particular, something in the here and now. But it can also be reported as a sequence or event, something from last week or between sessions, between two or more family members. So this is an emerging pattern of how a family members relate to one another. And keeping in mind that it's possible to make many different observations of what seems to be just one event, and that therefore any observational statement is highly selective. So we're being very selective about what we're pointing out, making sure we have noticed this, enough evidence to see this might be that pattern. And we voice to the family, what do you think about this? And so this is maybe a few snippets of what I might say with Ann and Dad. I was wondering if I could put something out. What do you think just happened with Ann right now? Dad, it seemed that when you were starting to talk about Ann's grade, she may have shut down a bit. Did I get that right, Ann? Dad, did you notice that? Dad, I wonder what Ann was feeling just now. Of course, I'm going to let them answer between each question, but this is the spirit, right? Does this happen often? Does this feel like a pattern? So we're noticing this. Are you seeing what I'm seeing? Another example might be, I noticed that you guys all talk at the same time often and have them reflect on that and notice it. As we go down to the 29, we're looking at naming. So once we notice it, we're going to kind of form a working party with the family to think about some sort of kind of from a meta level, from the bird's eye view as to, you know, what this looks like from above. So maybe even helping them find some buzzwords to mark the interaction sequence and associated feelings. So Ann and Dad happen to be, you know, and the family enjoyed boating. And this is what came up kind of naturally, is missing the boat. And so what we talked about in our session was, so, you know, here's me helping name, is what just happened here? Let's rewind and think about this. Dad, why do you think Ann is feeling upset? And can you help him? So what word or phrase comes to mind when you think about this? Oh, she says, kind of like Dad missed the boat, right? Because he doesn't really think I'm upset about my grades, you know, because Dad doesn't even know that I'm disappointed myself. He just assumes that I don't care, right? So Dad's kind of missing the boat. In fact, Dad thinks you could care less and don't even care about school, when in fact you really do. And then you get defensive and he gets angry with you, you get angry with him, and he's missing you completely. So we're kind of able to kind of name this and say, this is Dad missing the boat. And so we're mentalizing, we go on to 30 and we mentalize the moment, right? What's it feel like to miss the boat? What's it feel like to be Dad when he misses it? What's it feel like to hear that Anne is actually doesn't want to disappoint you, but given what's going on in her life, really is struggling with this. So we're really encouraging kind of mutual exploration around this topic, and we gain momentum as the therapist can really kind of decentralize himself and see the role as a facilitator to enable these discussions between family members. And we're modeling the stance, but we're really getting a sense of mentalizing this moment, what it feels like right now to be dad and to be Ann and to be mom. And, you know, we do that by saying, Ann and dad, can we talk about this interaction? What was it like for Ann, you to feel your father is disappointed in you? What do you think this means? How do we end up feeling this way? Then we go into, so dad, you actually have been worried about her and not sure how to approach her. And did you know that? So we're really slowing down and looking at the feelings and what it's like in the moment. And then as we move to 31, we're looking at generalizing and considering change. Does this happen elsewhere, Anne and dad and mom? Does this kind of missing the boat happen in other aspects of your life at home, at school? Well, teachers often do this with Anne. It sounds like there's other places where mom may miss it. And that, for instance, maybe sleeping at night with her is not the most helpful thing. But in general, getting them to look at other places where Annie feels that she's going to disappoint her family or that she's upset them in some way and the family doesn't know what's going on. So we're all missing the boat in some way. So they're able to kind of generalize and look at other situations and also consider change. Is this something, I don't want to assume they want to change this behavior, but I'm going to ask, is this something you want to change? And then we kind of work towards what do they think could be different and helping them work through and problem solve. I wonder if it's possible for us to do something different. Do you have any thoughts? How can we work on this missing the boat? How do you want things to be different, dad? Any ideas how to get there? Same with Annie. So as we go on, three steps and three checks slide 33, we have kind of a review here. Is step one, notice the name. Check, is this what I noticed? Did you guys notice this? Let's name it. And then we check, is this what I noticed? And this is the way it may look like when things are happening this way at home. What do you guys see too? We mentalize the moment. We check again. So do we have this accurate? We're always checking here. At generalize and consider change, we're always checking because as 34 shows, checking has a powerful enactment of the therapist stance, right? We're respectful curiosity. We're expressed tentatively about mental state. We're checking, confirming the limits of our mind reading. We don't really know. We want to know. We're confirming, checking as affirming the value of mentalizing, that this is really important that we get this, and then checking at the end of the loop. We're even looking at the end of the loop to say, what was it like to look at this problem and to identify it in this way and to get the family to talk about it? So realizing my time is getting low here, but if you look on 35 and 36, what you'll notice are, it's kind of the loop discussed in the context of relational strengths of mentalizing. So when mentalizing is going well, this is what it sounds like, ideally. So, and what it feels like for families. But it's focused on the different relational strengths, such as affect focus, curiosity, perspective taking, impact awareness, agency, trusting attitude, reflective contemplation, and humility, compassion, humor, and playfulness. And it kind of goes through what it might sound like with Anne and her dad, and her mom. So with that, you'll see some references at the end, and I'm glad to provide anything else that might be helpful. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you so much, Chris. That was wonderful, giving us a really inside look into family-based MBT with a specific focus on adolescent work. I, of course, have many questions. We've got about 6 minutes left. But I'm going to first ask some of the questions that have come from the listeners. There's quite a few questions that's got to do with the structure of the therapy, and I think these are great questions. I'm going to start with them. So first question, at what age can you expect a child to participate in this kind of family therapy?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. I think it depends on kind of the presenting difficulties, but I've worked with kids as young as 6 or 7, And there's a nice book on, let's see, I have it here, Mentalization-Based Treatment for Children, and it's a time-limited approach. It's a very wonderful book. Nick Midgley, it has several here that I think that from the UK actually that developed, and it's got some really nice examples, but working with kids as young as 6 years old and older, and certainly adapting this, you know, for their specific difficulties. But yes, quite young, I think.
Great, yeah, and this is a related question. Is there a version with terminology that can be used with young children? I assume that Nick's book, I think Karen Ensink's also an author, but I assume that their book will give some of those pointers as to how to translate some of this. You know, I don't even know if they would recommend using the word mentalizing with
right.
smaller children. Yeah. All right.
Right.
Anything else on that, Chris, before we go to the next
no.
question?
No.
Okay. Here's another question about the structure. Do you ever meet alone with a parent?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think family therapy can take on many forms. I do meet with the parents typically when I'm meeting with a young person. However, with older adolescents, I might meet with the young person first, certainly meeting with the parents on the phone, but I might meet with the young person first just to develop that initial alliance and that I'm really interested in hearing in their mind, and haven't really heard much from their parents yet and offering this time initially, but absolutely I will, if I'm doing family therapy, I will sometimes meet with the parents separately, with the young person separately, and in some cases I'm even having all of them in session, but I might just focus on a parent and exploring the parent's mind. Especially starting off to get just a sense that the child might start to see dad start answering questions differently. So even in the room, I might focus on the parents, or I might focus on the child, mentalizing the child so the parents can kind of see some of that. So yes, I think it can take on many forms if I answered that.
So I'll ask a question that I had that's related to this. How do you make the decision as to whether, family-based work is needed or adolescent individual work is needed? How do you make those decisions?
Well, typically with any of this work, I prefer to have a team on board when I come in and working with someone, especially with high-risk behaviors. But I will say I really try to just join with the family and as I'm in the adolescent and as I'm getting to know their needs, I'm just very clear at the beginning that, family therapy, family work can be helpful in probably most cases. And I try to separate the fact that if they need their own individual therapist, I do that and I'm not doing both individual and family together for sure. But if the problems are primarily related to maybe family dynamics or the child's distress seems to be focused kind of on that, then I will probably start with family therapy and see how things go, especially if they've never had any treatment before, and meet individually some with the adolescent, young person and the family, and then kind of come together. A lot of times when I first meet with someone, I really just try to have them introduce one another to me. And in that moment, I can get a sense of, how they think and how they feel and if they need, separate therapies.
And in a case like Anne, there were three other children. Would you consider bringing those three children in, or do you work with your parents and Anne by themselves at first, especially if they're smaller kids and it's about self-harm and suicide? How do you think about all that?
Oh, absolutely. No, I never kind of take that off the table, and I just kind of make sure that anybody coming into the session is ready for it, and I really make sure to give the space to the identified patient and their parents first. But I think some of the more powerful sessions can come with sibling sessions when they're just together talking about some of the difficulties at home, and then maybe they feel okay enough to have the parents come in and talk about some of these things. But it's more towards once there's more stability and maybe an interest from the young person to try this with the siblings, if it's not like a primary presenting difficulty.
Okay. Well, Chris, you know, it's 7:59. I have a whole bunch of questions that I wrote down that I wanted to discuss with you, but I will call you and we will discuss this offline at some point, because this was just really stimulating and wonderful. And I just want to thank you for your time and your knowledge and for your investment in this population. Thank you for all you do and thank you for tonight.
Thank you. It's an honor. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.